Interesting to hear a mature audience being asked to turn their mobile phones off. I'm so used to that being requested and being abided by that I was surprised last week when I was lecturing as a guest at Sydney University. I took some time out from the office and also took some time off from being at home to conduct an evening lecture at Sydney University. And almost the entire time that I spoke, for an hour and a half, the students were texting and they're on their mobile phones. Now, within about half an hour, I'd had enough and I stopped talking. And I just stood there in silence, waiting. And suddenly all the people that were texting, they stopped texting. They stopped what they were doing on their phones, on the internet and what have you. And they looked up. And it was the first, I said, thank you, turn your phones off. And they couldn't believe that I was actually asking them to turn their phones off. They were sort of like, does he mean it? Does he mean it? And I said, yes, turn them off. Otherwise I'm not going to speak. And the professor got up and he said, please turn your phones off. And then I had to explain to them that I was taking time out from my family, whom I love. I was taking time out from the office where it's much more profitable. And I was doing this for them. And if they didn't want to be here, then they should leave if they needed their phones on. So I just thought, it's interesting, we hear it all the time, don't we? Just please turn your phones off and you respectfully turn it off. There's a generation of people out there who just don't understand what that means. And they go to university, which is remarkable. They're supposed to be intelligent people. Okay, I'm going to talk about a subject that I know you know, but I'm going to talk about it again, and that is value investing. Now, some of you haven't been to a session that I've given before, and I'd just like to know, hands up if you've been to a talk that I've given before. Okay, very good. And put your hands down, thank you. And hands up if you've never been to a talk that I've given before. Oh, that's almost half, okay, it's about half the room, thank you. And hands up if you're not going to put your hand up no matter what I ask. Very good, couple of truthful people. Thank you very much. Okay, I'm going to mention some stocks today, as I always do, and I'm not recommending that you buy them. I'm going to talk about companies that I like. I'll talk about companies that I don't like. If I talk about a company I don't like, it doesn't mean that if you own it in your portfolio, you should sell it. You do need to seek personal, professional advice, and that's what this particular warning is. It also says that we believe the information that we've got to obtain the presentation today is accurate, but it may not be accurate. Bear that in mind. And as always, make sure you seek and take personal professional advice. Okay, I'm going to give you some statistics, not because we want to boast. The statistics are here to give credibility to what comes after the statistics, that the particular approach that I'm advocating today does indeed work. These are the returns since inception for the Montgomery Private Fund. Now, I understand we've got some investors here today. Hands up if you're invested in the private fund. Okay, one. One person. Okay, well, that's a very lucrative audience for me. Thank you very much. Okay, David Buckland, you put your hand up, mate. David's our CEO. Come and see David if you're not invested in the private fund. He's got a booth. We've got a booth out there. You can come and see it. I just want to talk about these, thanks David, I want to talk about these returns, as I said earlier, not because we want to boast about them, they are very good, but I want to show you that what I'm about to tell you does in fact work. Despite its effectiveness, despite the efficacy of the approach, it is still unpopular. People don't do it. And I don't know why they don't do it, and I really want to drum in the returns, because when you look at these returns, you might ask yourself why you don't do it. Okay, so you can see here, compared to the ASX 200 Industrials Accumulation Index, since inception, which is about 2 years and 5 months, or thereabouts, 2 years and 4 months, you can see we've significantly outperformed that particular index since inception. If you have a look at all the other indices and you compare the results to the end of March, you can see that, again, the Montgomery Private Fund, using the approach that I'm going to describe to you today, has significantly outperformed each of those indices. And most of the stocks that we've got in the portfolio currently are smaller companies. CSL is in there and Cochlear is in there, but the rest of them are quite small companies. So I've thrown in the Small Ordinaries Accumulation Index there as well. It's beaten that index by about 50% over that time. If we have a look at the performance graphically, you can see that not only does this approach beat the market, or not only has it beaten the market, but it's also done it with less volatility. And in fact, $1 million invested into the index over the last 2 years and 4 months has turned $1 million has been turned into $1.12 million, but $1 million in the fund is now just over $1.4 million. Okay, in terms of our peers and other fund managers in Australia, if we compare our results before fees over a 2 year period to the end of March, and you have a look at that annual returns, you can see that the performance of this particular fund has not only beaten the indices, but it's beaten the indices by more than everybody else, just about. So this approach really does work. And I know I harp on about it, and some of you, those of you who put your hands up and said you've been to a session that I've run before, are going to get sick of hearing that you really need only a couple of key ingredients to do this well. The most important is the one that I can't give you or teach you, and that is patience. That's your parents' responsibility or your partner's responsibility. It isn't mine. Most of us aren't patient. We're in a mad rush to make money, either because we're really young, and the university students that I was talking to, I asked them to put their hands up. I said, hands up if you'd be happy with a 20% return on your investment. No one put their hand up. No one put their hand up. When I got to about 45 or 50%, there are a couple of sheepish guys down the front. They said, oh, yeah, that'd be pretty good. When I got to 90 to 100%, they all put their hands up. Yeah, happy with that. So young people are in a desperate rush to get rich. And then there are a whole bunch of people who are on the cusp of retiring. They're in a desperate rush to get rich because apparently when you retire, it all stops. And that's why it's all about turning 65, and you've got to make all the money you can before you're 65, because after that, evidently, it's all over. And I'm sure you'll attest to the fact that that's not the case, because if you're retiring today at 65, you may have 20 or 30 years of spending that you need to fund. So you continue to need to have growth. But very few groups of people seem to have patience. And so I'm going to give you some of the ingredients for applying the approach that we use in the Montgomery Private Fund and the Montgomery Fund. But what I can't give you is the patience, the ability to wait. Okay, so what do we do? Well, the very first thing that we do is we divide the market up very differently to the way the indices divide the market up. The market is cut up into companies, into sectors or indices, and they're categorised by size or by sector, the sector that they're actually in. So we'll have a resources index, we'll have a telco index, we'll have a materials index, and we'll have the ASX 50 and the ASX 100 and the ASX 200. Now, I'm going to stand here before you and tell you that I personally believe, it's just my personal belief, and I think this belief has been bought into by pretty much everyone at Montgomery. It isn't impossible to beat the index. In fact, over the long run, it should be relatively easy to beat the index. And why do I say that? Because I think most of these indices, because they're divided up into size and sector and not quality, there's a lot of rubbish companies in each of those indices. So if we go back a few slides, we have a look at these indices here, you can see immediately that these indices, nowhere there does it say high quality companies. Nowhere here does it say the best quality, the top 50 by quality, or the top 30, or the top 100 by return on equity, or the top 50 by little or no debt. It's just size. And so my suggestion to you is that we can actually invest better than these indices by creating our own indices that are based on quality. And so what we do, sorry, I have to go through this process again. So what we do is we divide the market up into 15 subsectors, and we rank every single company. Every single company has been ranked from A1 down to C5. Now, at C5, those of you who've seen the scaffold stand out the front, scaffold is the product or the application that actually shows you those particular scores for every listed company, and in fact it can do it for every company in the world. And we do exactly the same thing at Montgomery, and we're only interested in that top quartile or tercile, the top quarter or the top third of companies in terms of quality. Now, a C5 company is a company that has the highest probability, relatively speaking, the highest probability going bust. It doesn't mean it will go bust, but it has the highest risk of going bust. An A1 company has the lowest risk of catastrophe. It doesn't mean it won't go bust. It doesn't mean it's impossible, but it has the lowest risk of coming last, like a John Singleton horse. Right? It has the lowest risk of being last. Okay, so keep that in mind. It's very important that you understand. An A1 company is still a business. It still suffers from normal business cycles. It can still have a downgrade to its earnings, but it's got the lowest risk of catastrophe. Okay, C5 has the highest risk. So if we look at a company like this, ARB, and these are screenshots from Scaffold. If you have a look at this, this is ARB. ARB is the largest manufacturer of bull bars in the world, an Australian company run by Roger Brown for the last 36 years, manufacturing out of Thailand, exporting all around the world, 42 stores globally, only 42 stores globally. So you could argue it's a very good rollout story. They could have a lot more stores than that. This is a really high-quality company. That's what we're looking for. High quality businesses. Now, what do high quality businesses look like? I'll talk to you about this in more detail in a moment. But typically, they have very high rates of return on equity. They have very solid earnings growth. They have little or no debt. They're the sorts of things that we're looking for. Contrast that to this company here. Has anyone heard of Guns? Did anyone lose money when Guns went bust last year? Yes? One? Hands up if you lost money in Guns but don't want to admit it. Very good. Okay. So according to Scaffold, and certainly our review of Guns, if you go back to 2005, it had a 5 rating down the bottom. Now, we don't, at Montgomery, we don't invest in anything that has a 4 or a 5 in the performance scores, and we don't invest in Cs in the quality score. So if it's got a C, we don't invest in it, and if it's a 4 or a 5, we don't invest in it. So an A4 and an A5, we don't touch. B4, B5, we don't touch. C1 down to C5, we don't touch. So Guns was a 5 or a 4, since non-investable to us, back in 2005. And it hadn't been investment grade since. Have a look at another company here. This is Becton. Becton, the head company, went into receivership this year. The Melbourne-based property developer. Now, it hasn't been investment grade since it listed. It's never been investment grade. So you won't find a Montgomery portfolio investing in companies where there is a high risk based on the metrics that we look at, where there's a high risk of catastrophe. We just won't. But here's the interesting thing. Other people do invest in these companies. And these companies are in the indices. So there's inevitably periods where at Montgomery Investment Management, we will underperform the market. Why? Because the market has rubbish companies in it. And those rubbish companies occasionally go up in price. It's true that Gunn's share price between 2005 and last year, it had periods where the share price went up 30 or 40%. Now, we won't be invested in those and we will miss out. We will miss out on investing in bad companies that go up. That's a difficult thing for an impatient person to stomach. If you're impatient, you're trying to make money fast, and a stock that's rubbish goes up, you want to be part of that. It's going up. It doesn't really matter that it's rubbish. All that matters is that it's going up. Well, we don't play that game. We're not interested in bad things that go up, because inevitably they do. It's like going to the casino. Occasionally, if you bet on black, you'll win. But it's still gambling. And so we don't invest in rubbish companies. We don't invest in poor quality companies. Okay, here's another one. This is one that's not considered rubbish by most investors. It's considered a blue chip. This is Lendlease. Does anyone own Lendlease? Yep. One, two. Remember earlier, I'm not telling you to sell it. I'm not telling you to buy any shares or sell any shares. I'm just saying that based on our analysis, it wouldn't meet our criteria. It wouldn't be included in our portfolio. It's not high quality enough for us. And so you've heard this term blue chip. Everyone's heard it. I know you have. I don't know what it means. I really don't know what it means. I know that people think it means big companies that have paid dividends for a long period of time. Qantas was one of those companies. It paid dividends for a long period of time, and then what happened? It stopped paying the dividends. So we don't follow the conventional wisdom or conventional mantras about what's good quality and what's not good quality, because blue chip companies may not be good quality. Okay. So what is good quality? Well, I want you to turn the stock market off for a minute. I want you to imagine, I'm going to explain this chart in just a second, but I want you to imagine for a moment, I'm going to get off the stage here. I want you to imagine for a moment that we're going to get together, you and I, personally, one-on-one, and we're going to set up a business. So my job is to run it for you. You're the money bag. Okay, your job is to fund it. You're going to seed it up. I'm going to run it for you. Okay? It's 2003. It's the year 2003. And we need $184 million of equity to kick the business off. So reach into your pockets, pull out your checkbook, and write a check to Virgin Australia Holdings for $184 million. Okay, and I'll get the laser pointer again. Bear with me. They always drift away. Okay, so that black column or the grey column that you can see on the far left-hand side over there and over here, that represents the $184 million that you've put in. Now, also note that that's not enough to get the business going. We'll also have to go down to the bank together. We'll have to borrow some money. And what we'll do is we'll borrow $139 million, and that's the red column that you can see in 2003. So over there, the little red column there. So you've written a cheque for $184 million of your own money, and you've also borrowed $139 million from the bank. Okay, we'll run the business for a year. I'll run it for you. At the end of the year, I'll come back to you and report the results. And the results that I will report, this, we've made $110 million profit, which is equivalent to 59% return on equity. Okay, is that a good result or not a good result? I'm seeing good result. Where else can you get 60%? No one's sharing it, are they? They won't. They won't tell you. The kids at the uni, they can get it. That's right. So 60% is a great result, $110 million profit. You're so excited about that result, you say, Rog, go run it for 10 years. I'll see you in 10 years' time. I'm off on a holiday. And so you travel around the world in your yacht, and then you go on some river cruises through Europe. You do a couple of the castle tours, you know, in Ireland. What else do you do? You go to Noma in Finland or Denmark, wherever it is, that restaurant that charges, you know, $5,000 for a raw carrot. You go to all sorts of restaurants all around the world. You have a great time. You come back in 10 years and you say, Rog, how are we going? And so I come back and I report to you the 2012 results. Now, remember, back in 2003, we made $110 million on your investment. So you ask me how we're going. And I say to you, we're going pretty well considering the circumstances. You know, we had that GFC thing, you know, you've been on a boat. You don't know what's been going on. This year we've made $43 million profit. Is that good or bad compared to the old profit that we made? That's bad. $43 million. But that's not the complete story. Have a look at the grey column. That represents how much money you've since put in the business. You've now put in $929 million. You've written out checks for more money. Remember that earlier you put in $184 million at the start, you wrote a check? Well, while you were gone, you gave me power of attorney, and I've been dipping into your bank account and taking more money to help fund this business. because I'm growing. I need to grow. And so I've tapped into your account and I've taken $929 million. That's your money. Okay. Not only that, after I tell you that, you're not happy. Right? You're not happy. Because you turn around and you say, well, how am I going to repair the boat? But don't worry about that because I'm going to fly you everywhere in the plane. Right? So that's okay. But I also let you know, listen, we owe the bank a little bit more as well. And you say, well, how much do we owe? Well, remember we used to owe them $139, and you say, yeah, what is it? $200 now? You know, $200, $250? No, we owe the banks now $1.7 billion. That's this red column over here. These are real numbers taken from the annual report of Virgin. This is a real story. Now, let me ask you this question. If that was your business, not a listed company, not some sort of ethereal thing with a share, but your personal business that you own outright, how would you feel about this turn of events? Thoughts? Disappointed. I would like to work for you. I think you'd be a great dad. I could do anything I want, you'd be disappointed. Well, I'm sorry to disappoint you. What's that up the back? Thank goodness the NRA is not in Australia. Exactly. I think that's the likely response. You probably want to shoot me. But hang on a sec, no one's shooting anybody. This is a real company. It's listed on the stock exchange. They have an AGM. They have cookies and milk at the end. And, you know, they put slides up and they talk about how great things are going and they talk about their new planes and they talk about yields and they talk about fuel prices and all those things and everyone nods their heads and they go away and they buy the shares. Is something amiss? Something's very, very wrong. Now, if you've got the picture, now you know how we invest. Now you understand what we look for. We try and avoid those businesses. We try and steer away from those sorts of companies. So I put this little thing up and then we do that. All right. So would you like to see that again? I can show you that again. There you go. Here it goes. And there it is. All right. I did that this morning. I like it. Okay, so it's very simple. And I know we can all laugh about it, but the interesting thing for us is that these shares, the shares of these things, they go up. For us, the fact that they go up at all surprises us. You know, we sit there in disbelief when we underperform on a particular day because rubbish has gone up. And as I say to the guys, if they ever get disheartened, I say, look, even the steam on dog poo in winter goes up. Sometimes anything can go up, you know, so don't worry about it. But again, this is why, and I mean this in all seriousness, this is why we have to be patient. We have to be patient. There will come a time where a whole bunch of these things will keep going up for a while and we will underperform and our investors will say to us, well, why aren't you beating the index? I could have put my money in an index fund and it would have beaten you, Roger. Now, that hasn't happened to date and I hope it never does, but it probably will. And our response will be, we're investing in good businesses. We're not trading stocks that go up. And I don't think you should either. Okay, and here is the long-run share price for Virgin. So you can see there are periods where the share price goes up. Now, I know some of you in the audience look at that and you look at that share price and you say, well, Roger, I would have bought there and I would have sold there. And my response to that is, you didn't. In the short run, the stock market is, as Benjamin Graham said, in the short run, the stock market is a popularity contest, but in the long run, it's a voting machine in the short run. I think Benjamin Graham went on to say, and the voters are neither intelligent nor emotionally stable. All they have is money. But in the long run, the market is a weighing machine. In the long run, the price follows that economic performance that I described a moment ago for Virgin. So that story that I told you, that allegory that I gave you, that is how you need to think about businesses. And to do that, and they're the sort of businesses that we are after. This is ARB, which I showed you earlier, very high quality company, and you can see its intrinsic value is rising pretty much every year, and its share price is following. Over the long run, the market is a weighing machine. Over the long run, price follows the economic performance of a business. And here's another one. This is Google. Some of you think Google's one of these, you know, big internet companies and, you know, could be very, very risky. Well, I disagree with you. I think Google is one of these, one of the businesses that might just be the, you know, the telecom of the future. It might just be the business that we use the name of the company as a verb now. And we Google something. You know, when it goes into the lexicon and becomes a verb, you know, that's pretty telling. And their pricing power is absolutely phenomenal. We'll talk about pricing power in just a moment. Okay, so just so you know, just to let you know, go out and see Vanessa and Jeremy at the Scaffold stand later on, and you can have a look at some international companies on Scaffold as well, in all those different markets. Okay, so what are the things that we're looking for, again, to summarise, and you can write these things down. What are we looking for? Well, we need a couple of data points. We want to know the change in the equity over time. We want to know the change in debt over time. We'd like to know the change in profit over time. And you can use cash. Yes, you can use cash profit if you'd like. We want to know those three things. And then we want to know the return on equity. And for Virgin, the blue line was declining. That's the return on equity. We don't want a declining blue line. We don't want a declining return on equity. We want a business like ARB that has doubled or tripled its equity in the last 10 years, and yet its return on equity is still around 30%. It was 30% 10 years ago when its equity was a third as big, and now its equity is three times as large, it's still generating roughly 30% return on equity. You want a business that can grow its equity, grow the amount. Think about it this way. You've got a bank account, you've got two bank accounts. I'm going to give them both away for free. One of them has $1 million earning 20% a year. The other has $100 million earning 20% a year. Which one would you rather receive? The one with $100 million earning 20%. It's clearly worth more because it's bigger and it's still earning a high rate of return. It's the same with businesses. We want a business that has high equity, growing equity, but maintaining a high rate of return on equity. So that's what we're after. Okay. Once we understand that, what I'd like to do is take you through the process that you need to go through in order to find the best companies. What we're interested in are companies that have a very high margin of safety. Now, some of you have studied Warren Buffett. Some of you have studied Benjamin Graham. If you haven't, I advocate it. I suggest you go and read everything you can about Warren Buffett, Benjamin Graham, Charlie Munger, and devour everything that there is that they've said. That's important. Okay. Here's an interesting thing. Benjamin Graham talked about margin of safety. When he was referring to margin of safety, he referred only to the difference between the intrinsic value of a company and its share price. So if the share price was $5, the share price was $5 and the intrinsic value was $10, then there's a very great margin of safety. If the intrinsic value was $5 and the share price was $10, there's no margin of safety. The price is much higher than the intrinsic value of the company on a per share basis. But I'd like to expand this idea for you. I'd like to propose to you that margin of safety should exist in every aspect of your share market investments. What do I mean by that? Well, you can put money in a bank account today, in a term deposit today, and receive 4.3 or 4.4%. For you to invest in a company, a business, with all the risk associated with investing in a business, you need a margin of safety in the return on equity that it generates over and above the interest that you can get virtually risk-free in a term deposit. So you need a big margin of safety there. If, for example, you're looking to achieve a return on your investments in the share market of 10 or 11%, then you should be looking for a business that generates a return on equity with a margin of safety above that. So you should be looking for a business that can generate a return on equity of 20% plus if you're looking for a 10% or 12% return on your investment. Okay. I think the balance sheet needs to have a margin of safety. What do I mean by that? Well, the average company has about 40% leverage, is about 40% geared. So So we're looking for companies that have less gearing than that. We want a margin of safety in the level of gearing as well. Less is more when it comes to debt. Okay, when it comes to return on equity, it's as Mae West said. I often get the question at the end of the session, what is an appropriate rate of return on equity? Well, there isn't an exact rate, there isn't an exact number. But Mae West famously once said, too much of a good thing is wonderful. Right? So think about that when you're thinking about return on equity. Okay, so the process involves a margin of safety in every aspect of what we're looking for. Then what we do is we have some valuation models. So we have a number of valuation models that we combine, we run actually simultaneously, and we throw up to the top of the list those companies that are the good quality companies that are cheap by either model. We don't care which model is saying which is cheap, we just want to throw those stocks into the mix. We want to be able to see them. One of the models is based on margin of safety and return on equity and the things that I've just talked about. And the other model also takes into account liquidity. Because we're managing $320 odd million and that's growing all the time, as our returns go up particularly, we can't invest in the very smallest companies. But you can. But you should take into account liquidity anyway. How long, if I put $100,000 into this share, how long will it take me to get out of it? What if things go badly? I need to know that I can get out relatively quickly. So we throw liquidity into the mix. The other thing that we look for in the second model is that we're looking for companies that generate high rates of earnings per share growth. We're looking for strong earnings per share growth. Warren Buffett famously once said, put together a portfolio of businesses, notice he didn't say stocks, put together a portfolio of businesses whose earnings march upward over the years, and so too will the value of the portfolio. So we want strong earnings per share growth in this second model that we run. And it's important we don't use, in this second model, we generate our own earnings per share estimates. What we've discovered in our back testing is that our estimates seem to be better than most of the analysts. They tend to be more accurate. Now, we're not going to propose that that will always be the case, but we think that analysts have some biases because of who they work for. That means that sometimes they're more optimistic. Sometimes they're pessimistic, but more often than not, they're optimistic, more optimistic than we are. And so we run our own internally generated earnings per share and earnings per share growth rates. And then one little thing that you've never probably heard me talk about, and this is in a white paper that we wrote called What's Under the Bonnet, we look for non-random price information as well. We believe that there's in this model, the second model that we run, we believe that most of the price action that you see, most of price movement is largely random, and it's largely just noise, particularly in the short term. But occasionally you see a share persistently going up when the historical information you have about that company doesn't suggest that it should. And the forecasts that you have about that company don't suggest that the share price should persistently be going up. Now, we don't buy those shares because they're going up. I told you earlier, in the short run, there's a lot of very silly things going on in the market. But we throw those into the mix as well because it forces us to have a deeper look. And a company last year that met that criteria that we bought was a company called Certex. Looking at the historical information and looking at the analyst forecasts, we couldn't see any reason to buy the shares. But the share price movement caused us to have a deeper look and to talk to the company and understand the business better. And when we did that, we realised that there was some value there, that it was indeed a high-quality company and it was cheap. And so we bought it and we've subsequently done very well out of that particular business. Once we've run these two processes, now, what's the lesson for you in all of this? There is a lesson in this for you. Have a process. And have a process that is consistent. If you don't have a consistent process, if you don't have a consistent way that you do things all the time, you'll never know whether the thing that you're doing is actually working or not. If one day you take something you heard on the radio as a suggestion for a stock in your portfolio, Then you read a newsletter. Then you have some software. Then you watch TV on, you know, you watch a TV program on Sunday morning, and you listen to an interview with the CEO, and you buy shares all these different ways, or you get a magazine, you read the newspaper, you get a bit of this and a bit of that and a bit of that and a bit of that, and you build a portfolio. You don't have a portfolio that is following a consistent approach. You have a hodgepodge of different ideas. If it goes well, you were lucky. If it goes badly, you don't know what to fix. And so it's imperative that you have a consistent process. We have a quantitative process. To this point here, before we start looking at these companies in detail ourselves, up until this point, there is no human intervention. It's all just computers that generate this for us. It's all quantitative. Only then, the quantitative process throws up the stocks we need to have a look at, and then we look at them more deeply, and we look at them in a qualitative fashion. Okay, what we did is we got a government-funded research centre that is run by Alex Freno, who's a professor at Sydney University, and we asked them to go and back test over 10 years, just the quantitative process, just that bit where there's no human intervention. How would it have gone if we just picked the 40 top stocks using that process every month and we reweighted them every month so that the top 40 were always invested in from 2002 through to 2011-2012 through the GFC? How would that have gone? Well, the green and red lines represent two portfolios, the two different streams or processes that we run side by side. The green one is one and the red one is the other. And the black line represents the index in that time. So just the quantitative process on their own seem to work, and sometimes we get a little bit nervous about doing anything ourselves because we wonder whether or not that by doing the legwork and doing our own analysis, whether we'll actually detract from that. But we believe that we can add value. We believe that over the long run, we can actually reduce the volatility of the portfolio and reduce its risk. Okay. So, what is the qualitative process? Well, it helps if you're smart. Okay, it does help. Now, I'm not smart enough to do it all myself. So I think we've hired some really smart people. And last year, we brought on David Buckland, who's in the room. David was the CEO of Hunter Hall for 11 years, and he came and joined us last year in June. And then we hired a really nice guy named Tim Kelly. Tim ducked his MBA at the Australian Graduate School of Management. He then worked at McKinsey's, and he then worked at a company called Gresham Advisory. And he worked on the BHP-Billiton merger, and he worked on Wesfarmers' takeover of Coles, and we don't hold that against him. He's worked on a lot of the very big deals in Australia with big names. So he's a very, very bright guy. So I thought to myself, well, you know what, I'm not smart enough to do this consistently. I'll hire some people smarter than me. So it does help if you've got some bright people. But it's also helpful if you've got business experience. And I know many of you in the room have run your own businesses. If you can remember what it was like and what was necessary to succeed in business, you will be a good analyst. If you can remember that the reported profit that the accountants told you you made and the profit on the tax that you had to pay, if you can remember that that profit figure had no resemblance or bore no resemblance to the actual cash that you took home, if you can remember that, you'll understand that you need to look at cash flow when you're looking at a company's accounts. If you can remember that all of your best marketing efforts still made the business tough to run, it didn't matter how hard you tried in marketing, it still made it tough, then you will know that when you find a business that is succeeding, they are doing something in their marketing that is not easy to replicate. Because if it was easy to replicate, it was just a matter of putting up a website and advertising in the yellow pages and putting it out on TV and radio. If it was that easy, everyone would do it and everyone would be equally successful. So having business experience, Some business experience can make you a good analyst. But essentially, it comes down to understanding the economics that I described earlier when we looked at Virgin. It really is that simple. And there are only four things that we looked at, weren't there? The change in the equity, the change in the debt, the change in the profits, and the return on equity. Look at those four things in detail and understand how they've changed over time for a business, and you'll quickly be able to sift out the rubbish companies that are burning shareholders' funds. Okay. I decided that I wanted to give you some value for your efforts in coming here today. So what I thought is I'd give you a list of companies that are high-quality companies. Now, I only prepared this list this morning. I'll keep the slide up for a minute or two so that you can write these companies down, because what we all like in Australia is a shortcut. That's why so many people play lotto. It's a shortcut to freedom, isn't it? It's also a long road to impoverishment, but we will, you know, as my mum said, you had to be in it to win it. And I used to reply by saying, how to go broke saving money. So here are some companies. I'll read them out, and I'll tell you, if you don't know what they do, I'll tell you what they do briefly. Seek is an online job site. The best businesses in the world, the best online businesses are simply lists of jobs, lists of houses, lists of holidays, lists of flights, lists of websites, lists of names, LinkedIn, Facebook, that sort of thing. They're just lists. The Reject Shop, you'll know what they do, I'm sure. They've got an 80 or 90% brand awareness in Australia amongst the adult population. CSL is a mining company. It is. It is a mining company. It mines blood. And guess what? Blood, the product that it sells, isn't cyclical, like iron ore and gold and coal and all those things. We're always going to need more of what CSL makes. Okay? So that's a good mining company to be in. Credit Corp is a debt collection company. Lots of people have debt. We should send Credit Corp over to talk to Treasury in the United States, see if they can collect their debt. ResMed, I'm sure you know what ResMed does. Does anyone use a ResMed product? Probably won't want to admit that, will you? It's really romantic. It's a mask that you put on your face at night in bed. It helps with sleep apnea. I guess if you're trying to sleep, you're not trying to do anything else anywhere, so you can wear the mask. JB Hi-Fi, you know what JB Hi-Fi does? They will mature, ladies and gentlemen. The Reject Shop, JB Hi-Fi, Seek, they will eventually mature in this country. We've only got 22 million people. Cash Converters is a retail concept, an interesting one. The stores are being bought back. The franchise stores are being bought back by the company. They're being tarted up, got better lighting and all that sort of thing, and they're profiting from that process. Macmillan Shakespeare is a salary packaging company. Kathmandu is that retail company that you never buy stuff from until it's on sale. And it seems to always be on sale. But guess what? You all know it, and it all works. It works really well. Cochlear, hearing implants, baby boomers. Cochlear started off making hearing aid devices, or the cochlear implant, for profoundly deaf infants. Profoundly deaf newborns. Thank you. 15 minutes. 1 minute. Oh, 15 minutes for questions. Feel free to interrupt me at any time with questions. Okay, Cochlear. But here's the thing. Cochlear's market is about to explode. Why? Because of the Beatles. Because of the Beatles and AC/DC and U2 and all those bands and the Rolling Stones, and because of all those bands. See, the guys who play in those bands, they wore earplugs. But you didn't. And so there's more and more people in the generation after them, my generation, Sony Walkmans, playing them too loudly, really close. iPods, playing music too loudly. And so their market will increase. Okay, I'll go through these quickly. Ainsworth, some of you might abide by it, some might not like it, poker machines. Ramsey, healthcare, primary healthcare. IMF, litigation funder, okay, providing the opportunity for people who otherwise couldn't get redress to do it collectively. Flight Centre, you know, Certex, we talked about. M2 Telecommunications, Telco. Silver Chef provides funding and financing for cafes and restaurants. You might think, gee, that's a risky thing to do, financing equipment for cafes. If you talk to American Express or Visa, right through the GFC was the one sector of the economy that never went bust. That part is absolutely surging. Okay, and then down the bottom, car sales, REA Group, Iris, ARB, 1300 Smiles, What If, Worley Parsons, Thorn and Webjet. Just very quickly talk about Worley Parsons. High quality business. There's some others in this space. They're a mining contractor, a mining service business. Very high quality companies. Great balance sheets. Their returns have been fantastic. High rates of return on equity, little or no debt. Amazing. If you pull them, they come up in our screens. When we run our screens, they're at the top of the list, these mining companies. But what we're uncertain about is what happens in 2015 and 2016 if the iron ore price slumps. And we think that it might. And if it does, what happens to these mining services businesses? And because we're not certain about their future, because we're not confident about their prospects, we're not prepared to buy them, even though our quantitative process throws them up and says, you really need to have a look at these closely. Okay. So what do extraordinary businesses look like? Very quickly, four quotes from Warren Buffett. What you want is big equity and big returns on that equity. We've talked about that. You want an easy to understand business whose earnings are virtually certain to be materially higher 5, 10, 20 years from now. You want businesses earning a good return on equity while employing little or no debt. And you want a business with bright long-term prospects. I'm going to fast forward now very quickly. I'm going to skip all of this because you've seen it all before, so don't worry. And I want to talk about valuing a company. Okay, in the last 3 or 4 minutes that we've got, I want to talk about, and then we'll open it up to questions. I read in the Financial Review last week, one of the journalists wrote that quote at the top. The old ways to value banks no longer apply. When was the last time you heard someone say the way to value companies or businesses, the old way, no longer apply? Cast your mind back to 1999. The dot-com bubble. You remember the old P/E ratios? They don't work. Dividend yields, price to revenue, none of that stuff matters anymore. Well, I read last week that the old way to value banks, that doesn't apply anymore. Okay, let me warn you. The old ways of valuing companies will always apply. The way to value a business always applies. Now, what's popular at the moment is to throw valuation out the window and go for yield. And you can get some very learned people getting up, appearing to be very expert in their ability to forecast interest rates and to forecast what's happening in the global economy, and it all sounds very, very intelligent. And what they're saying is that this will run for a while. People are going to keep chasing yield because interest rates around the world are going to continue going down. That's great. In other words, the party will keep going for a while. The party will continue. But eventually the party will stop. And let me assure you, outside as the participants at this party become increasingly inebriated, outside there is a line of taxis waiting, but there aren't enough to take everyone home to safety. Quick couple of tables and we're done. This top table is Telstra, showing what would have happened to your money if you bought Telstra shares on a 7.4% dividend yield back in 2005 when it had a very attractive yield. Now back then you would have earned $7.40 of dividend for your $100. Fast forward to this year, and your $100 has turned into $91.62. Interestingly, your dividend, that $7.40, has turned into $5.18. So your capital has gone down, and your dividend has gone down as well. But it was an attractive high dividend yielding stock back then. It's being pitched as an attractive high dividend yielding stock today. Contrast that to a company that had a lower dividend yield, M2 Telecommunications. I showed you the list. I showed you it was in the list of high quality companies. You put $100 into that, it had a lower dividend yield at the time, just 4.2% compared to 7.4% for Telstra. So you only would have received $4.20 of dividend that year. But if you'd held on to that stock, your $100 has now turned into $1,644, and your $4.20 dividend has now turned into $54. So all I'm saying to you is, the old ways of valuing a business, the old ways of valuing a business are still relevant. And if you want to know how to value a business, you can grab a copy of this online at rogermontgomery.com, or talk to David and the team over at Montgomery, or go and see the guys at Scaffold. I think we've got a little bit of time for questions. We've got a few minutes to take some questions. I'm going to give two copies away for the best questions as our session finishes. They are rare copies. They are unsigned. Okay. I want to thank you all for your attention today. Thanks very much.
Stay here.
Yep.
I know there are people who want to ask questions. I'd like to ask you to please go to one of the two microphones, introduce yourself, please, and put your question. If you can keep your questions fairly brief, then we have more questions in the time we have allowed.
Thanks, Roger, for an excellent presentation.
Thank you.
Worth the price of the conference on its own, in my opinion.
Well, thank you very much.
If everyone, eventually, your proselytizing will spread all over the world and everyone will have your book and everyone will have an edition of Scaffold, and we'll all be picking over the same top left-hand corner of stocks. So isn't that going to bugger the system? Shouldn't we slow down a little bit?
No, it won't, because you just said the top left-hand corner, and the ones I'm looking at are in the top right. But having said that, Warren Buffett has been talking about this approach to investing since the 1950s. And there isn't a mass migration to it. You know, I know that I will be in my 70s and 80s and presenting this stuff, and I'll still receive that question. What if everyone starts moving towards this? Don't worry about that occurring anytime soon. Okay, thanks very much. Another question.
Just checking. Thank you, Mr. I'm just checking your opinion about Telstra. At its bottom, it was about $2.60 or thereabouts.
56.
And it appeared to be very good value at that price. Mm. There was a hiccup of what the government was going to do with it, and it did it, and it didn't seem to do it any harm. So that those prices at around $3 with a very high yield in a company which is not a monopoly, but a duopoly or a triopoly or something, you know, very satisfying to an investor, that is.
And what's your question?
The question is, did you put that up as a kind of company that, you know, why did you put that company up as a good company to invest in? It's been a very good company for me, I might say. Why did you put it up as a company for the future?
Oh, no, I didn't. Telstra is a business which at the moment, I don't think there are any analysts in Australia that with any degree of confidence could possibly know what it's going to earn in 5 years' time. You cannot know what it's going to earn in 5 years' time. Its popularity currently is predicated on this chase for yield and the stability of its dividend. But its forecast earnings for 2014 are no higher than the earnings that it generated in 2003. So over 11 years, there's not forecast to be any growth in its profits. We don't own it, and at $2.60 or $2.56, we had a valuation of close to $3, and we didn't buy it. Now, the returns that I've generated, that we have generated in the Montgomery funds, we've done that without Telstra in the portfolio, so we don't miss them, and we're not missing them. But our valuation for Telstra is still around that $3 level. It's nowhere near where its share price is today. Now, other people will disagree with us on that, and that's absolutely fine. We don't mind that they own it. And they may own BHP, and we don't own that one, you know, and they've done badly in BHP. So, you know, we don't mind that we don't own every company that goes up. We're just going to play the game, the football game that we play. They might score a goal in soccer or shoot a basket in basketball and there'll be a big cheer go up over on their ground, but we'll just play our game and it doesn't involve owning Telstra at the moment.
A supplementary question. The fact that it's a kind of a duopoly, surely that is helpful to it. And the fact that the management appears to be able to extract extra value with a commodity which is bound to increase with population increase.
You might be absolutely right, and I wish you the best of luck. And all Telstra shareholders, it could go up, it could double from here, and that would be great. That gentleman there, just one mic. We'll just use... Okay. You can stay here, but I'll come. I'll point you in a second. So, guys, I'm not saying Telstra's good or bad. I'm just saying we don't own it, and it could still double, and that's fine. We're just not going to buy it. I'll take your question, and then we'll come back to your question. Okay, go ahead.
Out of the 20-odd stocks you had on the board there before,
yes,
about a third of them are shopfront retail.
Yes.
How do you build into your valuation the risk of the internet and online shopping?
Well, do you know what? The risk of the internet and online shopping, it is here now. It's here now, and yet on the weekend I went with my kids to a Reject Shop store at a Westfield in Chatswood, and we went to the JB Hi-Fi store, and the kids thought it was pretty exciting. Normally they thought, Dad, do we have to go and talk to the manager? No, we don't have to talk to the manager. But, you know, they were excited because the Reject Shop, they could actually afford something from their pocket money, and JB Hi-Fi, well, they'll just go and play the iPad minis. So they're delighted, and the stores are full. Now, the internet... You know, the internet exists, and the customers that are going to these shops can buy their products on the internet, and yet they're still shopping in these stores. So I think there is a risk that the internet will have an impact, but it'll have impact on some businesses less than others. At the moment, we own these businesses. Our view could change tomorrow, and we may sell them. Yep. Okay. Yep.
Thanks, Roger. My name's Doug Campbell.
Hi, Doug.
The earlier part of your presentation... we could have been listening to another company that plays in your sort of field that probably a lot of people are familiar with, earnings per share growth and all those sorts of things.
Sure.
But you came later on to the qualitative part, which attracted me. But unless I missed, I didn't hear anything about feeling comfortable with the directors, with corporate governance.
This bloke was winding me up, so I couldn't go into it. But I'd love another 3 hours with you. You know, I'd love to. We could talk about it and get a whiteboard up and talk about all that. I have a view. Look, a couple of my very, very good friends run mergers and acquisitions in the biggest investment banks in the world here in Australia, and they get to meet management. They get to meet management all the time to talk to them about acquisitions and capital raisings and all those things. At the biggest companies in Australia, they get to see it from a side that I don't get to see. We meet management, but it's always, everything's always happy and going well, and, you know, nobody ever says, by the way, look at page 96. Notice we tried to shove something under the carpet there. You know, nobody ever does that. But on their side, they get to see warts and all how the businesses are going. The interesting view that I've shared with them is that I actually think the business boat you get into is more important than who's rowing. Because it doesn't matter who's rowing Virgin and Qantas, those boats have a hole in their side. Right? Now, they might not sink, but the management's going to forever be bailing out that water that's filling up the boat, and they won't be able to row as fast as they could. And even if they could row really fast, the boat's still taking on water. So it's not going to go as fast as some other boats. So I just think the business boat you get into is more important than management. Now, they've also said to me, and I won't quote who it was, but many years ago, one of them said to me, Roger, I've yet to find a manager that truly, hand on heart, above all else, is willing to put the shareholders first. No? And that was a few years ago now. Maybe there are some now that exist, but I don't know. You decide. Okay. I hope I've answered that question.
Thank you.
And we'll take the last two and then we're done.
Linda Martin.
Hello, Linda.
Hi, Roger. Why do you like Ainsworth?
Why do I like it?
Yes, I'm holding it and I've held it for a while.
I don't... Look, I have a real debate with the team on this one because we've done very, very well from owning shares in that particular company. I would never, ever, ever, ever put 1 cent into a poker machine. I can't think of anything... more mindless than doing that, and I appreciate that there's a very, you know, it's a very divisive issue. We will donate the profits that we make, or part of the profits that we make in our business, to charity, and one of those charities will be anti-gambling, anti-alcohol, anti-smoking. You know, we'll do what we can to help society, But I really hold that one with an open hand and say, look, take it away from me, give me any excuse at all. The reason I like it is I think that they're doing much, much better than all of their competition. And they are growing that business surprisingly quickly and much faster than the data suggests. And that's why we like it. It was also cheap when we bought it last year.
Thank you.
A pleasure.
Hi, Roger. My name's Paul Dalpuget.
G'day, Paul.
How are you?
Very well.
I just noticed that there was nothing in the resources sector at all that came up on you.
No, mind. That's exactly right. I have a view, and it is just my view, and it'll take me 30 seconds or so, or plus a minute or two either side, to answer this one. It's our internal view, right? This is the Montgomery view. If you look at Scaffold, for example, a lot of mining services companies come up. If you look at our Montgomery process, Scaffold's part of that process, the mining services companies come up. They're high quality businesses, they've got great balance sheets, they look cheap at the moment. And their profits have been very good to date. We believe, we have a thesis that the iron ore price is going to drop significantly sometime in the next 18 months. We don't know exactly when that's going to happen. But we can't, using normal economics 101 demand and supply analysis, see how the iron ore price will stay where it is. Between 1974 and 2004, the iron ore price traded between $10 and $20 a tonne. Between 2004 and 2011, so in that seven-year period, because of the emergence of China's infrastructure capital expenditure, the iron ore price went from $20 a metric tonne to $187 a tonne in 7 years. Go back throughout history, it's never traded there before. Now, why did it run up so hard? Because there wasn't enough supply and there was massive increase in demand as China started building roads that no one drives on, schools there where there are no students, cities where no one lives, bridges that no one crosses and shopping centres where no one is shopping and there aren't any shops. They've done that. They've finished doing that. They've built enough infrastructure now. And they've plainly said we're now transitioning to a consumer-led growth in our economy, not this infrastructure spending. They will still demand more iron ore from Australia, but the rate of change, of increase that they'll need is going to come down. At precisely the same time where the amount of iron ore we're digging out of the ground is about to go up. Mm-hmm. So when the rate of growth slows and the supply increases, my economics 101 tells me that the price of that commodity has to come down. Now, I could be wrong, and I'd be delighted to be 100% wrong, but at the moment, that's what we think, and that's why we're ignoring all the signals that quantitatively tell us we should be looking at these and we maybe should be investing in them. Our view disagrees with the quantitative, and so we just stand aside. And we just invest in the things where they align. That's our view.
Okay.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, I sincerely appreciate your attendance. I think it's lunch break now. I'll stay around for the next hour or so come and say hello. Thank you again.
I want to add my thanks to that of the audience. It's remarkable that all of you, despite your hunger, have stayed to listen. This is a very worthwhile presentation. Many times we listen to a speaker and we don't scrutinize what he looks like. This gentleman has been talking to us about how to make money, about profits. I want you to note that he's wearing a black tie, not a red one. And that really epitomizes what he's been talking to us. He's been talking to us about looking at companies that are in the black, yesterday, today, and hopefully tomorrow. And here you are. Thank you very much. We wish you well.
Thank you very much. See, I will tell you why I chose black this morning. I thought, well, I'm talking about the stock market. I'd normally wear this tie to a funeral. It's the same thing. That'll do.
Lunch is located one level down. As you leave here, just go down one level, please.